This is an RTRFM podcast. RTRFM is a community organisation and relies on volunteer and listener support. To learn more about what we do, visit rtrfm.com.au.
This is a war between the government and the Tamil people.
I'm not a fucking terrorist. You are the terrorist.
People are crying out for justice in this country.
If you've got to be militant to achieve your aims and your aspirations, so be it.
There's a real hypocrisy from the big corporations.
The people from below will push for real change.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?
Welcome to the Indie Media Show on RTRFM 92.1, the sound alternative. My name is Ramon Grenfell. I am joined in the studio by my illustrious co-host, Martin Martis Martinis Alexander Wisson. How's it going, Alex?
Well, I mean, you've missed out a few of the honorifics there in my title, including KCMG, Lord of the Realm,
Honorifics for those with honour.
But as a socialist, I take seriously the royal titles that have been bestowed upon me. But no, other than that sign of disrespect, wonderful actually, right, to be in the studio. It's actually, I'm being sincere, it's actually a wonderful day out there, so it's... innovated me and rejuvenated me.
Alex has a mild pink shirt with flamingos on it.
Absolutely. I was just thinking that. I've got a bit of almost sort of a summer holiday vibe going on with my pink shirt and flamingos. So it's all happening here in the studio here at RTRFM.
But look, before we get too silly, a massive thanks and love and respect to Mr. Jeff Bullen, the man of the golden voice, for another superb edition.
Absolutely, sporting,
on the record.
Like, very slick, like very kind of 1986 Run DMC.
Yep. Adidas
tracksuit on. Yeah, it makes me think of 1986 Run DMC.
And also congratulations to Mr. Bullen for a nomination in the Community Radio Awards.
Well deserved. Hardworking, humble champion.
Anyway,
of the station.
You can catch Jeff next week, but of course you can catch On The Record every weekday here at RTRFM from 9 in the AM. This is the Indie Media Show. It's the news and interviews from the open publishing wires of the interwebs. We are all about citizen journalism, activist media, that kind of thing. We like to think we try to get to the root cause of a lot of the issues that we face in our contemporary world, so different social, economic and environmental justice issues. This week we're going to be carrying on reporting on the Land Forces exhibition that took place in Melbourne, or NAM, last week. You may recall that we've spoken to a couple of people in the 2 weeks prior, but we're going to get a bit of a report from one of the organisers, Lewis. Obviously, there's been a lot of reporting in the corporate media about the police brutality, but also sort of framing protesters in the usual sort of, frankly, quite absurd light of criminality and violence. When it's one of those things, isn't it, Alex, that you 20, 30 years of watching this stuff, and you see these news reports with violent protesters while you're watching police fire rubber bullets and pepper spray, elderly men and women, and it's just the absurdity of it is quite remarkable. But
if it wasn't so serious, there would be a strong comedic element to it, Ray. And as you say, we're both a little bit long in the tooth. We've been in this political game for a long time, and there is something comical and absurd about this pre-filled script that is trotted out by the capitalist press every time there is a major demonstration of this kind. And I think you have to view it in the perspective of it being inherently threatening to the quotidian, day-to-day stability of the state, is threatened however mildly. You don't want to overstate that. We're not talking about an urban guerrilla group on the streets here. But there's no part of what's significant about it is there's no ideological defences anymore, for why this arms fair should be supported and multi-billion-dollar contracts supported. So the state and the media allies resort to, these people are thugs and virtually terrorists. And it is amusing seeing the same accusations that I've seen for many, many years. A favourite one is water balloons filled with urine thrown at police. That's one they often trot out as a pre-filled lie. They didn't use this one. Instead, this time they went with acid. Absolutely no visual evidence or any other evidence of any kind to suggest that anything like that happened throughout the 3 days of the protest. So it went from, you know, acid being thrown in the faces to police to, well, we think it was an acid-like substance to, well, it was some sort of unknown liquid that was thrown in the faces of the police. Now, there were a few your water bottles and there were some horse manure actually thrown at police on horses. You know, the bits and pieces of projectiles being thrown. But, yeah, of course, even then, you could see just even a few minutes of the footage, you can see that's quite obviously done in the context of self-defence against overwhelming physical superiority and monopoly on violence that the state has. It's just inherently the case that the state has that monopoly on violence, and a water bottle being thrown in response to that is, you know, if you construe that as violence, then you need to kind of, I think, question your perspective on reality. If you think a water bottle being thrown against heavily armed officers is violence, it's beyond ridiculous. It's not a serious argument.
It's also interesting, I guess, to think about how the media coverage really focuses in on the conflict between the state via the police and demonstrators in a way to really, I guess, change the narrative, disorientate people, move the narrative away from the fact that, you know, people, the reasons, the actual political nature of the demonstrations, the fact, and the nature of the arms convention itself, and of course Australia's support for the ongoing genocide in Gaza, and our support for the US military industrial complex. And it does, I think it serves a very important, I guess, role. And that's something we'll be talking to Lewis about a little later in the program. Also, I believe we're going to have a bit of an editorial from yourself, Alex.
Yeah, well, I want to discuss in some detail some of the latest developments in the Russo-Ukrainian war. But if I may, with your indulgence, Ray, I did want to make a few sort of editorial comments about something. Well, I was going to say something a bit fun. It's really not fun at all. I suppose you have to have a pretty dark sense of humour to find it funny. But this is extraordinary business in the latest debate between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump. Many of you may have seen the debate or the highlights of the debate. And a lot of focus, and it's been memeified already, of course, of Donald Trump's claim that cats and dogs are being eaten by Haitian migrants in Springfield, Ohio. Now, if you haven't seen this, it is amazing. It's worth going back and looking at the footage. I actually went back and watched most of the debate online, and it was sort of one of those double take moments, even by the lofty standards of dissimulation and disinformation by Donald Trump. He really outdid himself on this occasion, where he literally said that cats and dogs are being taken off the streets of Springfield, Ohio. Now, just for background, there has been quite a large number of Haitian migrants fleeing basically a disintegrated, crumbled state there. There are gangs that have taken control of Port-au-Prince. There's no functional government, no functional health services, education, anything there. People fleeing that country. And a Haitian community is built up around a small town of Springfield, Ohio, which significantly is the home state of Trump's vice presidential running mate, J.D. Vance. He's, of course, a Republican senator from Ohio. And it was J.D. Vance who was mostly got the ball rolling on this when he claimed these cats and dogs were being taken. And then other Republican politicians took up the mantle. And this is where it is almost comical. On X or Twitter, the Republican Congressman Tom Tiffany said, "Cat lives matter." while a Republican Congressman Andy Biggs of Arizona posted, "Protect America's pets." And then very quickly, there were AI-generated images of Trump with kittens and ducks saving them from Haitian migrants. Now, you know, I laugh, but it is pretty grim stuff, because one of the first groups actually to this ridiculous rumour, by the way, started on a Springfield Facebook community group where apparently some random person said, yes, Haitians are taking cats and dogs. And there was this other story about a group of Haitians being seen with geese in their hands. Now, one of the groups very early on to spread this rumour was Blood Tribe, okay, which is an out-out neo-Nazi group. And also a woman by the name of Laura Loomer, who's a conspiracy theorist and a racist. She said that if Kamala Harris wins the presidency, quote, the White House will smell of curry. Just a vile, disgusting racist, Laura Loomer, who's been actually travelling with Trump in his private jet. So the speculation is that this random conspiracy theorist has maybe spoken directly to Trump and given him this idea of cats and dogs being eaten by Haitian migrants, and he's run with it in the presidential debate. So there you go. It's just sort of an interesting example of the way disinformation spreads. So it starts in a Facebook community group. It's spread by J.D. Vance and other Republicans, and it's actually spread by neo-Nazis.
Mm.
And when I saw this comment, Ray, that was the first thing that struck me, is that it shows how far we've come in mainstream political discourse, that I'm old enough to remember that a comment like that, that Trump made in a presidential debate, you know, on mainstream television, millions of people watching, literally the kind of comment that not that long ago it would be restricted to neo-Nazis, and yet here we have President Trump, you know, talking about it. So amazing stuff.
Just to stop you there, Alex, for a second. The one thing that strikes me with that, and we are rambling a lot here, though, is surely, even if that were the case, if people were so desperate, and look, I love cats and dogs, but if people are so desperate, so impoverished, they're eating cats and dogs, the response to that would be, my God, we have to help these people.
That's right.
My God, we have to help these people. Well, no one is eating cats and dogs just out of, for shits and giggles.
Correct.
It's absolutely absurd. But anyway,
this is the level of hysteria.
This is the madness that we're dealing with.
You know, something's gone wrong when it's a police spokesman who's a voice of reason, because Springfield Police Division told National Public Radio last month, I think it's sad that some people are using this as an opportunity to spread hate or spread fear. We haven't really seen anything like this. As a community, it's not helpful as we try to move forward. So there you go, the police being anti-racist allies in that instance.
RTRFM 92.1.
You're on the Indie Media Show on RTRFM 92.1. If you're a regular listener to this program, you would know we've been covering quite extensively the Land Forces exhibition in Naarm or Melbourne. It took place last week. Some thousands of demonstrators took to the streets on multiple days to protest the Weapons Expo taking place in the centre of Melbourne. Predominantly pro-Palestinian activists and other anti-war and peace activists engaged in a diversity of tactics to try and disrupt this convention of essentially mass death and war. A little earlier today, I had the opportunity to catch up with one of the organizers of the demonstrations, Lewis, and I just started by asking and talking to Lewis about what actually happened last week. Lewis, many of our listeners would have seen the quite dramatic and incredible, and I guess for many of us, inspiring scenes coming out of Naarm, Melbourne last week, with the massive demonstrations around the Land Forces Convention, the Weapons Expo and exhibition in the centre of Melbourne. Look, we've probably seen a lot of what went down, but can I just start by asking you to give us a bit of a report and a summary of what happened last week? There were some major demonstrations. You know, how many people turned out, and was it, how successful was it at disrupting this Weapons Expo?
Yeah, totally. So we had multiple events across multiple days, kicking off things. We kicked things off on the Sunday before the actual opening of the expo itself. But the expo opened up on Wednesday, which was when we had the main picket held. And then subsequently we held other events up until the Friday of the last day of the expo. So we saw a pretty big variety of actions ranging from picketing to more passive actions, just to try and include a wide variety of people and make that as accessible as possible.
Now, there has been, similar demonstrations in the past in Melbourne and elsewhere, and I guess, you know, our older listeners will remember the S11 demonstrations in Melbourne, from many, many years ago. But I guess, you know, you need a bit more time and space perhaps to assess everything that happened. But I guess from an organizer's perspective, from people who participated, do you think that it was successful in actually disrupting the convention and the expo to some extent? And in terms of, you know, I did hear reports that, you know, there were delays in getting some of the stuff in, and you know, there were delays in some of the participants actually getting into the center.
Yeah, for sure. I think we did do what we set out to do, which was make this event as uncomfortable as possible for any delegates or participants going to support such like an unjust and disgusting exposition. Yeah, we were doing all kinds of things to make it as unenjoyable as possible for all these people going in, whether that be during the picketing, harassing people going in, or like you said, during the bump-in phase, we had people block roads and make that difficult to bump in this merchandise of death.
Now, the corporate and mainstream media's portrayal of these demonstrations, not unsurprisingly, has focused on, you know, this so-called criminality of the demonstrators, claiming that people were throwing manure and all this sort of, and it's the usual sort of story. And also, on the other hand, there has been, some reportage of the police violence. I guess in terms of, the local, both local people in Melbourne and more broadly it was represented, do you think there was, an adequate or fair representation of what happened? It sounds like there was a real diversity of tactics and many people involved. And as I said, it's not surprising the media focuses on that. But it must also be quite frustrating when, you're seeing front page articles of, violent protesters, when really from all reports I've seen and heard and the footage I've seen, there was really just extreme violence from the police force.
Yeah, I think we were expecting, coming up against the military industrial complex, that we're going to face some pretty stiff opposition regardless of our actions. We definitely came at it as peacefully and with the intent to remain, be non-violent regardless of the actions that we're taking. But I think the ridiculousness comes down to when you see these media reports and the footage that they show is not of protesters being violent, but people getting thrown to the ground by riot police with shields, getting beaten, pepper sprayed in the face at close proximity, and a blatant disregard for the safety of protesters. And we saw that consistently throughout. But like I said, many of us in the group had the expectation that the state would come down hard on us. When you're coming up against such a force that is the military industrial complex, the state doesn't really look kindly upon that at all.
And really, the police force are a part of that. And I guess one thing that we might consider is that, the police force and the way they act at these conventions and exhibitions is a sort of an example of what people are really demonstrating against, particularly the increasing militarization of the police. However, I just wanted to ask you, when these demonstrations occur, all around the world, there's often a focus on, police brutality, police violence, and the, conflict with the police between demonstrators, activists, direct actionists, and the police. Do you ever think that perhaps, or at least in this instance, that could be considered a sort of a deliberate ploy to distract people from, some of the other issues surrounding these demonstrations? The fact that, the media, have really focused on this conflict and on the violence, and it forces us as activists to really, ourselves focus on it as well, perhaps to the, detriment of actually focusing on what we're demonstrating against, such as the genocide in Gaza.
Yeah, that's a really great point. And yeah, I 100% agree. It serves as both a diversion for the general population and also us organizing. The amount of time and energy and resources that we had to put into keeping our community safe and ensuring that people are cared for within these situations and also afterwards was really large. Yeah, I think these diversion tactics really do serve the purpose of detracting from the true point of all this, which is really soul-crushing at times, to be honest, when you pour so much energy and time into creating a diverse and poignant arrangement of activities to really draw people in from all walks of life and all different understandings to educate people and raise awareness. And the whole week gets reduced down to a single event. And I think the best way to kind of combat this is to stick to our stories, stick to truth telling, and maintain that focus on what's really important. That's disrupting the arms industry, drawing attention to disarming and putting an embargo on Israel, and stopping war, stopping the support for war all across the world, not just in Gaza, but also West Papua. Stop arming the Indonesian forces there. Australia plays a big role there with the Bushmasters, and all other places where genocide's occurring. All these places are only enabled to do these things by weapons procurement, which is supported by all the companies that were at this expo and also the state.
Definitely. Now, I guess focusing on perhaps on that, sticking to that to our stories, to sticking to our own sort of political and social agendas for peace, really. Obviously, a large coalition of groups came together to participate in this demonstration, and people from all around Australia and perhaps even elsewhere came to converge in Melbourne to say no to this particular arms expo. Of course, many of our listeners would have participated in anti-war demonstrations over the years, and many of us would have been involved in the demonstrations against both the invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq. And I'm sure there's even people listening that are involved in anti-war demonstrations from even prior to that time. It really, in one sense, it seems that to be anti-war, to be pro-peace, is not particularly controversial. And I'm sure there are many people that didn't even go to the demonstrations in Nam and elsewhere around the country that wouldn't support the weapons expos and using our tax dollars to perpetuate war. However, we don't really have a strong and robust anti-war movement in this country, unfortunately, anymore, and probably haven't done so for a long time. Were there any, I guess, positive signs at least coming out of this convention that it may build and move towards a reignition of the anti-war movement here in Australia?
Yeah, just to like continue on your point there, I think you're absolutely right. We have lost a lot of steam in terms of the anti-war movement. I think the separation in people's ideologies of how state actors and also private actors engage with each other to perpetuate these things is really out of the frame of conscious mind for a lot of Australians. And, this is done purposefully. I think what we saw throughout the week really does show that this kind of conscious thought is rising again. And I think particularly with what's going on in Gaza and Palestine, has really drawn attention to all this stuff is continuing to the same degree that it did all those years ago, like you said, when all these other, when the anti-war movement was really alive. Not much has really changed, except more private actors are coming into play and they're perhaps a little more behind a veil curtain. I really have strong hopes that people are starting to understand how much of a role these plays in human justice and rights, but also environmental issues that we're facing today, which is, a driver of all these problems and will also continue to raise tensions throughout the world and escalate the need for defense, quote unquote. I really hope that this opposition to war really, really continues to develop and build a strong, strong opposition.
Lewis, just finally, before we let you go, obviously, you know, while we mentioned that the focus on the police brutality and so forth sometimes detracts from the message, there is the reality that many people will be, having to go through court now. Many people will be considering perhaps their own legal action against the state, given the brutality of the police in Melbourne last week. What can our listeners here do to support people that have been impacted by that police brutality? Or, you know, I guess beyond that, what can we perhaps do to get involved and, you know, maybe people who want to get active again after seeing, what were quite incredible and inspiring scenes coming out of NAMM at the Weapons Expo?
Mm. So on our website, you can find some links to a Chuffed donation pool, which you can help out with some legal costs. But what I would really love for people to be doing right now is reinforcing the real narrative amongst their communities and amongst people that they know, because that's where the real truth lies. And I think we really have to engage as a larger community, as like a nationwide community, as a global community, to really counter these toxic and degrading narratives of outrageous kind of vile commentary, which excludes and detracts from the real meaning of these things. I think that's probably one of the best ways that people can really help and support the movement as a whole. In terms of engaging and finding ways that they can help, I definitely say looking and asking around your own communities. You know, these things are going to continually pop up more and more. So get together with some friends, find people that align with you, and find ways to get involved in your local community.
That was Lewis, an organiser for Disrupt Land Forces, the demonstrations that took place last week in Melbourne, or NAMM, talking to us a little earlier today. And this is the Indie Media Show on RTRFM 92.1. Myself, Ramon Grenfell, and Martin Alexander Wisson.
Now, this is not, if you like, an official edition of Field Notes on the Road to Global War, because it's got a bit of a more specific focus on the Russo-Ukrainian War. I wanted to make a few comments about some of the latest developments in that all-important war. Of course, listeners who are following the news, keeping abreast of the latest military, political, economic, diplomatic developments in the Russo-Ukrainian war would know there was this huge development with the incursion, invasion, call it what you like, into the Kursk Oblast. Now, Ukrainian troops, of course, still holding ground. The Russian Defense Ministry is claiming that they've retaken around a dozen settlements in that Kursk Oblast, and even the Ukrainians aren't making any claims that they've gained any additional ground. So it very quickly, actually, within, a couple of weeks, that new theatre, new front in Kursk actually took on the dimensions of the other theatres, Zaporizhia and Kherson and Donetsk theatres, in terms of being a war of attrition, so not a war of movement and combined arms assaults and dynamic infantry air support attacks. And that speaks partly to the fact that Ukraine simply doesn't have the aerial capacity for true combined arms assaults to take further ground. It's been an ongoing problem for the Zelensky government since the very start of the war, that lack of aerial superiority. You can only take so much ground, using a combination of drones and infantry and armoured fighting vehicles and tanks that they have. We do know that they're using their German Leopard tanks and British Challenger tanks, some of which have been lost on Russian territory. But nevertheless, a war of attrition and something of a stalemate on that new Kursk theatre, although no likelihood that the Russians will beat back the Ukrainians any time soon. That's one I got wrong. I actually thought the Ukrainians would be turfed out of Russian territory within 48 hours, but it wasn't the case, and so it's hard to know exactly what Putin's strategic thinking is there. There is an argument perhaps to be made that he's almost willing to sacrifice a strong argument to be made, willing to sacrifice at least part of that oblast in terms of then drawing it into to Russia's strategic advantage by drawing away some of the best trained, you know, youngest, most well-equipped Ukrainian soldiers from the Donbass and potentially stuck in that quagmire in this new Russian theatre. So the bigger, you know, geopolitical dimension of this is you know, a lot of talk of red lines you'll see in the coverage of the Russo-Ukrainian war. There was an initial brief panic that incursion into Kursk was crossing one of those very red lines, which is in all kinds of alarmist rhetoric as to what that actually means. It's a term we see all the time in terms of the Middle East as well. You know, how will Hezbollah respond or Iran respond if certain red lines are crossed? And a lot of commentators don't ask the question of exactly what that means, but there is that strategic ambiguity. Will Putin use, you know, mini caliber, you know, nuclear, mini threshold, mini yield, rather, nuclear weapons? Will he increase conventional arms? And he keeps that deliberately ambiguous. But in terms of you know, escalation on the other side, in terms of NATO, the latest talk now is increasing pressure from Zelensky for the long-sought-after long-range cruise missiles. We've seen all along throughout the war just sort of this gradual escalation in Ukraine getting it what it wants, essentially, in terms of eventually got the ATACMS munitions from the United States. It eventually got F-16s. Just briefly on the F-16s, that's something of a joke. Around 61 F-16s secured, only about 24 pilots to fly them, because it's a long, you know, sort of training build up to get people to sufficiently fly these things. Already two of those F-16s lost, by the way. But the long range missile question is a really important one. It seems probably a little bit dry and boring. I'll go through a little bit of that detail now. So, and forgive the kind of the militaria esoterica, if you like, but Storm Shadow missiles supplied by the United Kingdom have been the main air-launched cruise missiles used by Ukraine. They were provided early on in the war with supposedly, on the basis that they weren't to be used to attack Russian targets. They have a range of 250 kilometres. They've been used very effectively to attack the Russian Black Sea fleet in Crimea, including, in particular, a stunning assault in September last year on the Black Sea naval headquarters in Sevastopol, which took out a leading general. And also a leading flagship was blown up as another major attack on Sevastopol in December last year, was similarly successful. So it's thanks to the United Kingdom that the Storm Shadows are used, you know, behind cover, using Sukhoi 24 fighter bombers and other Sukhois as fighter escorts. So they've been, even though they're, you know, more advanced weapons than these old Soviet fighters, they're, you know, adapted to those Soviet fighter jet bombers to deliver those Storm Shadows. The ATACMS that I mentioned have a range of 165 kilometres. And there's also, very similar to the Storm Shadow missiles, the Ukrainians have been using the French-designed Scalp missile. It's also got a range of 250 kilometres. Now, one reason that the French and the British are hesitant to supply more of these missiles is because they've got pretty low stocks. And that's, for people who are interested in, you know, military affairs, a really interesting side note. Just generally with the Russo-Ukrainian war is I think sometimes it's easy to assume, particularly the Americans, but even the British and French have, you know, sort of almost unlimited supplies of these things. Very small in number and extremely expensive. I mean, several million dollars for each of these missiles. The UK has only 850 of them. Only 850 of them. The French have only 460 their Scalp. So you can imagine they are hesitant to provide them. Perhaps most significantly of all, the Germans, and so far German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has pointedly refused to provide any long-range missiles. The weapon the Ukrainians most want to get their hands on is the Taurus, the German-designed and made Taurus missile, which has a range of 500 kilometres, so twice that of the Storm Shadow and the Scalp. Much better design, much more accurate, And it could really a game changer in terms of the potential to attack major Russian cities, deep in Russian territory using the Taurus missile. Now, and just the politics of that, the optics, if you like, to use that newfangled jargon of a German long-range ballistic cruise missile being used to attack Russian cities is an interesting prospect. So as we go to air, basically, the British Prime Minister Keir Starmer has met with Joe Biden, and there was an expectation they were going to give that official approval for these long-range missiles being supplied, but they've now pulled back from that. So a little bit of sanity, you might say, but then they're going to revisit that decision a little later this month as to whether or not to deploy long-range missiles. Why am I going on about the long-range missiles so much? Because it is a genuine game-changer militarily, and then therefore also politics, war being a continuation of politics. By all the means, as von Clausewitz understood, because there is then all kinds of escalation on either side. More sanctions on Russia announced, by the way, by US Secretary of State Blinken. And there has been speculation of, we talked about the ambiguity of what crossing red lines means. You can take this with a grain of salt, Western media propaganda, but speculation that the Russians will massively increase cyber attacks and maybe even attacks on undersea communications cables, that sort of thing, black ops, as a response to these long-range missiles being deployed. I think ultimately we don't know what will happen. It's just entering yet another dangerous phase in this war. It's a series of phases, each of which has been more dangerous as we progress along the pathway of this now 3-year-long war. Make no mistake, it's more than just military wonkery, if you like. The question of these long-range missiles has an impact on the war and on European politics generally and global politics more broadly.
And it's now time for a little bit of indie media news. Continuing on in our reportage of the ongoing genocide and war in Gaza, Israeli strikes killed at least 40 people across Gaza late last week as UN Chief Antonio Guterres once again called for an immediate ceasefire following Israel's massacre at the UN-run Al-Jauni school, which killed at least 18 people last Wednesday, including 6 UN employees, one of the deadliest days in UNRWA's history, UNRWA's history. And the World Health Organization said Thursday that it had evacuated about 100 people in need of medical treatment from Gaza to the UAE and called for regular evacuations to resume after Israel's assault decimated Gaza's health system. And in related news, the WHO says 25% of Palestinians in Gaza, wounded by Israel's ongoing assault, have life-changing injuries. The UN is warning the Palestinian economy, which was already devastated before October 7th due to Israel's occupation and blockade, is in freefall and could completely collapse. In the US, a North Dakota judge struck down the state's near-total abortion ban last Thursday, ruling North Dakota's constitution ensures the right to an abortion before fetal viability. While the ruling is a major victory for abortion rights, North Dakota no longer has any abortion clinics after the overturning of Roe v. Wade triggered the state's ban. If the ruling is not overturned in an appeal or the state legislature does not pass a new ban, North Dakota could join Minnesota as a haven for patients seeking abortion care in the Midwest. And staying in the U.S. in quite inspiring news, some 33,000 Boeing workers in Washington State and Oregon walked off the job after overwhelmingly rejecting a new contract. It's Boeing's first strike in 16 years and has halted production on most of its aircraft, including its troubled 737 MAX. Workers are seeking pay rises of 40%. The tentative agreement only pledged to raise wages by 25%. And in related U.S. industrial news, hotel workers in Boston, New Haven, and San Diego have launched a second wave of a phased strike that started at hotels around the U.S. on Labor Day. In Nigeria, people are searching for their loved ones after major flooding has killed at least 50 people, submerged entire neighbourhoods and displaced tens of thousands of people in the northeast. And in India, authorities have declared a curfew and shut down internet access across the northeastern state of Manipur amid a surge in violence between the majority Mai Tai and minority Kuki communities. At least 11 people have been killed in recent fighting. That includes weaponized drone attacks on civilians launched by suspected Kuki fighters. More than 200 people have been killed since the violence broke out last year. Tens of thousands have fled the region. And on Wednesday, student protesters marched to demand an end to the violence. That's about all we've got time for, Alex, unless you've got a bit more commentary or news or, you know, a couple of jokes for our listeners. And you are renowned.
The listeners love my humour. I mean, the ratings just go absolutely through the roof when I use my comedic wares. But, sort of reflecting on the protests in Melbourne, really, and just how small numbers of people can shake things up. And whether or not you agreed with those tactics over in Melbourne, it did get me thinking again about the relative vulnerability of the state, without wishing to overstate it. Just the fact that, 1,000, maybe 1,500 people brought the centre of Melbourne to a standstill is something worth reflecting on. Like I say, you don't necessarily agree with those tactics, but well done to those comrades over Melbourne in terms of what they did. Hopefully more to come. We need bigger numbers, clearly, and wider social forces to be involved, and then things might actually start happening in this country. We never have any events in this country. I was saying that to a friend the other day. French philosopher Alain Badeau talked about how we no longer live in the era of events, in a postmodern era. There are no events in the historical sense that happen in Australia. So we need, an actual historical event to take place at some point to shift the polity in this country, into a more humane, civilised direction.
Just quickly, I think on that, as we talked about off air, there's many ways to look at those demonstrations in Melbourne, and perhaps it is, it's quite disappointing to not see a big turnout, particularly from certain sectors of civil society, and namely the trade unions, and especially as we also discussed, it's, rightly a lot of the, a lot of activists and far left came out in support of the CFMEU as they've been placed into administration, and perhaps it's unfortunate to not necessarily see that, that solidarity from trade unions to peace activists and anti-war activists in Melbourne. I'm sure there were many trade unionists or members of their trade unions there, but in no sort of visible
organised fashion.
So that's, it's quite saddening, especially if we think back in fairly recent history, only 20 years ago during the demonstrations against the Iraq war, the CFMEU pulled its workers off all job sites around the country when the invasion commenced, and they were massively involved, at least in the beginning, in some of those demonstrations, as were other trade unions around the country. So bringing unions, church groups, other civil society organisations back into the anti-war movement, huge, huge ask, might not even be possible, because let's be realistic, the anti-war movement, if it exists at all, is very much only being run by socialists and anarchists and, perhaps long-time peace activists. But in terms of bringing those people into a very much needed anti-war and peace movement and bringing those coalitions and networks and groups back in, huge work, but hopefully, what's occurred in Melbourne might reignite that fire a little bit.
And just briefly, I mean, there is, I say there's no historical events that take place in Australia. I don't mean that as a joke. I mean that quite seriously. And there is something to this, the reaction to what happened in Melbourne, where, oh my goodness, this is actually a small episode of real politics. It's sort of like real politics puncturing this somnambulist bubble of just nothing ever happening in Australia. So it's got to be a good thing in that sense, where it's just business as usual all the damn time in this country. And it's a slight puncture to that quotidian, dreary reality of Australian political life.
What a point! What a point to end on. That's all we've got time this week for the Indie Media Show. We'll be back next week. If you've enjoyed the program, you can always restream it. You can listen to our individual interviews on our SoundCloud. You can get in touch with us via the RTRFM offices.
Thank you for listening to this RTRFM podcast. RTRFM is a community organisation and relies on volunteer and listener support. Visit rtrfm.com.au for more podcasts and other great content, as well as details on how you can support the station. You can also download our app and access RTRFM anytime and anywhere on your mobile device.